This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey, I'm Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we work to end the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real-life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates, as we debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, frauds, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, Hunbuds and Hunbros. It's the end of April. We have finally reached the end of our deep dive into the exploitation and abuse of children, but it's not going to end that topic. There are already so many of you who have reached out and thanked me for talking about these topics, who have reached out and shared their own stories and expressed interest in possibly sharing their story on the podcast as well. So this is not going to end. You guys know that. It is just the introduction into this topic, as it will be coming up in later episodes. And we like to have a really broad understanding of the topics, because then when we talk about it in all the different niches and nuances, and we have a little bit more education, and we can come to those conversations just a little bit more well-informed, and then pass on that information to others as well. I absolutely love how we do that and we prepare on this show, and this month was definitely not an exception at all. But like I said, I have been talking to other survivors of these sort of abuses, and there are much, much heavier episodes coming. We just sort of need a break for a bit, you know what I mean? This is a really heavy episode with a lot of content warnings. We're going to be talking to my friend Shelley Snow Pordia, who experienced child sexual assault during her time with the IFB, or the Independent Fundamental Baptists. Yes, we're finally talking about the IFB. Shelley told me it's pretty much purity culture on steroids, and I would have to agree with her. This episode is heavy, but like always, there is humor. Shelley is an incredible speaker, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy her story. She actually goes into more detail in this podcast episode than she has in any other podcast interview. So I'm really excited for you guys to meet her. She is so wonderful. I think you're just going to adore her as much as I do. But I just want you to be prepared. Other than that, I am still just devouring the Tortured Poets Department. If you haven't listened to it yet, I mean, like really genuinely listened. It is like poetry. Michelle and I have like gotten to the point where we're breaking down each song as a poem. It really feels like English lit all over again. And it's been a really fun experience for us to do that. If you are a Swiftie and you listen to the show and you are clowning about TTPD2 and you're like, I need somebody to talk to who gets it. We get it. Join the Discord. Not only do we have a Swiftie thread, we have a TTPD thread specifically for all the clowning, all of the theories, all of the ideas, all of the memes, all of the, oh my God, did you hear this? Oh my God, did you see that? It's there. It's there for the taking. I would love if more Swifties that listen joined, because I have so many theories and everybody I know has already heard them. So if you're into it, please, I think we'll probably do more stuff in the future. For me, it's just something to take my mind off of the really heavy, dark stuff. It's still emotionally charged, but I'm choosing it. So I saw this post on Threads and I shared it the other day and it says, quote, TTPD isn't relatable, said the person who wasn't a millennial lovey fucked over by the tattooed skater kid. And honestly, it shows. I also want to welcome our newest Patreon member, Tabitha Zeitlow. Welcome. It's so great to have you. I hope I said your last name right. And lastly, because I'm a proud mom and I share a little bit of our real life on the show, and you guys have kind of gotten to know my daughter Abby through the years and her very limited appearances on social media and on the show, but today we actually were at the local parade where we live in town. There's a rodeo and they do like rodeo days and this whole thing. And she's in the beginning band at school because she's a sixth grader, but she works so hard. And the teacher said, any beginning band sixth graders who want to be part of the marching band for the parade, you can audition to get a spot. And so she did, because she's an overachiever, and she got a spot because she's amazing. And she got to march in the parade today and play saxophone. And it was so cool. And she looked so cute. There's a picture and a video on my Instagram if you guys want to see it.
Hey, Mom.
What up? I was just talking. Actually, come here.
Yes.
Hi, Abby. I was literally just
talking. Hi, Mother.
I was literally just talking about you and your parade today. How was it? How did?
Oh, I'm so tired. My feet hurt.
Okay, but like you were amazing.
Was I?
You were amazing. How did it feel to march in the parade with the advanced band?
It was cool. I made a lot of friends.
That's good.
I'm very tired though.
Yeah.
My lungs.
Anyway, you heard it right from her. It was great, but she is unbelievably tired. I am also tired. It is tough being a mom. Anyway, enjoy this episode. We'll see you next week. Welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. We are continuing our deep dive and education into the exploitation and abuse of children. So today's episode, it's going to be heavy, but it's also going to be really interesting because I know you just from working in like cult related things, but I've never actually heard your story. I've never sat down and like actually heard your story. And so I'm kind of going into this blindly. I have a good vague idea just because I know you, but we're going to tell the story and we're going to figure it out and we're just going to have a good time. So I would love to welcome to the show my friend, Shelly Snow Pordia. How are you doing?
Hey, thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you. How about you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing really good.
Good, good.
Yeah. Just trucking along.
Yeah. I'm excited to finally be able to do this because like you said, we know each other and yet, you know, we've discussed MLM stuff and went to a writing workshop together. And
right.
You're a beautiful writer, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just fun to be able to like, oh, actually get to talk to you about my background because it's somewhere we've never gone.
Yeah. I know. I'm really excited. And in all of April, we have been telling stories about exploitation of children, troubled teen industry, Munchausen, different stories like this, cults. I know you have a cult background. I know you have a very traumatic childhood, but that's, I don't know the details. So let's jump into this. Let's start at the beginning and let's learn all about your life story.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in the Independent Fundamental Baptist cult, IFB for short. You might be familiar with the documentary, Let Us Pray. That was actually the college that one of the girls went to, was the same one that I attended, grew up in that church under Jack Hiles. And so that's how it started. Of course, you know, I didn't realize that I was in a cult growing up.
Right.
But, you know, it was that really hostile, abusive environment. I think they even showed a clip on that documentary in particular, which I think there might, I don't know if there's been many on the actual IFB, but anyway, of Jack Hiles waving a gun, you know, in front of his congregation and saying things like, if a man is in prison for rape, there should be a scantily clad woman, you know, in the cell next to him for her part in the crime.
Wow.
Yeah. So pretty culture on steroids, really.
Yeah.
Really heavy in patriarchy.
When did your parents join this?
I believe they met each other at a Campus Crusades for Christ. It's still around, but it's called something different. From there, I believe my dad's church kind of shifted and joined that movement, the IFB, in the 60s. And then I was born in the 70s. And so it just kind of like snowballed. The leader right during the time when I was born was featured in Time magazine. And so, you know, that's one of the things that people might have this misconception about cults, so that they are, you know, some guru in the small setting or on a compound or, you know, these group of 50 wearing robes and doing, you know, but for in our case, it was a leader who was preaching to thousands of people every week and being featured in things like Time. So like in the 1970s when it really started to gain momentum, and then in the early 80s, it had like its peak. And that's when I was there.
Wow. I mean, you talk about sort of this like edification of these cult leaders.
Yeah.
And it was really happening in the 1960s and the 70s. There's this counterculture movement. People are coming out of the Vietnam War. There's a lot of feminism and just a lot of different movements were happening at that time. Civil rights movements, everything is happening right around the same exact time. And these counterculture movements, these like really wild Christian organizations, or even like Jonestown, these leaders are getting so much recognition in the public as like men who are just doing the best they can do and just really saving the planet. And so it's interesting for you to say that your cult leader was featured in Time magazine.
I know, isn't it crazy? It wasn't the cover or anything, but there's like a few page spread story. The claim was that we had the world's largest Sunday school.
Oh, wow.
I don't know who checked those facts or whatever, but it was said that we had about 20,000 on campus every Sunday.
Wow.
So again, I don't know the fact checking that went into all of that, but as late as 2017, they did claim to have 12 to 13,000 people every Sunday on their campus. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I actually remember watching a series, I believe it was a Hulu series called Mrs. America with Cate Blanchett. And it's a historical, I don't know, I wouldn't call it fiction, because it's like about Gloria Steinem and Phyllis Schlafly, who was from St. Louis, which is where I'm from, right? And so I realized in watching that, I'm like, oh my gosh, it makes sense that my parents made the choices that they did, because like you said, it was like coming off the Vietnam War and everybody was like counterculture, and it was a shifting away from, you know, this conservative 50s lifestyle. And then you have Woodstock and people are like, well, it's gone off the rails. People are topless. You know, everybody's on drugs. Like, we got to rein this thing in. And so it makes sense that somebody came along and was like, I have all the answers.
Absolutely.
Isn't that easier than trying to figure out the answers yourself?
Yes. Some flashy guy comes into town with his cool wagon full of snake oil. And he's like, I have the answers. I'm the magic guru. You have problems? I can solve them. And people who are just so desperate and so scared too, right? Especially growing up conservatively and then seeing all of this hedonistic stuff happening all around you, all this stuff that the Bible has said, like, oh no, beware of this happening. And you're watching what you believe is happening to be the same thing and going, oh, we need a savior. We need someone to come and help us. We need someone to steer us back into the right direction. We've lost sight of what's right and true and just. We need somebody. In this act of desperation, and this man is like, I could do that. Sure. Yeah. Okay. I could be that guy.
Yeah.
And just swoops in.
Yes.
And just saves everybody that feels like they're lost, really. The ones that feel like they're looking for something, he just comes in and says, I can provide this for you.
Yes. And it starts out as like, I have the answers. And then it turns into, you have to follow me in everything. So it's like when my parents, this is like happening when they were teenagers, right? And then, you know, they fell in love, they got married, and everything's turning and shifting. And it just seems more and more dangerous. And like you said, in the culture, it seems like, yeah, it's the moral majority, which wasn't quite formed yet, but it was forming at that time, right? And we have these liberal feminists that are trying to take over everything. So, like, which side do you choose? And, you know, that's, we were smack dab in the middle of the country. They were born and raised in St. Louis, and they kind of took a really expected path. Now that I, you know, have learned a lot of stuff, because looking back, you know, and asking them questions, it's like, how in the world? What were we thinking? I get what I was thinking when I was all bought in because I was born in it. I didn't know any better, right? But you had other experiences. But like I said, when you learn from history, it does kind of paint the picture of like, oh, okay, I can see why those choices were there. And it helps me, you know, with the anger that I have of some of the things that happened too, of like not being so judgmental and harsh on them. Like, you know, I do believe that they were doing what they thought was best.
Yeah. So. I mean, that is a side effect of unpacking, right? It's like you unpack and you go, oh, this is something that happened. And then you have to sort of unpack that and say, was this malicious or was this ignorance? Was somebody doing these things to me intentionally to hurt me? Or did they just not know any better because they were told that this was okay? And when you look at the cultic background, and like you're saying, like the leader is like, not only do you have to believe what I say, but you have to do as I do and live as I live, or at least as I'm portraying that I'm living and believing. You need to be in my image the way I'm in God's image. And it just all goes into it. Just, it makes total sense when you really unpack it and you look at every single thing that informed their decisions. It's really like, would we make those decisions today? Well, no, not knowing what we know. But at the time, that was as much of an informed consensual decision that they could make with what information they had.
Right, right. It's hard to find that balance between excusing poor behavior and, you know, understanding that people make mistakes. And yes, this was what they considered the best choice at the time. They were saving humanity, in quotes, or they were saving their children from the devil, that kind of thing. Right. So I'll move on a little bit in the story, is that when I was 4 years old, my dad decided to go ahead and follow that preacher, Jack Hiles, and enroll in the seminary. Oh. And so we moved from, you know, St. Louis to the headquarters, is what I call it. I don't even know. It's like a mega church, like whole system that they have up there. They own blocks and blocks of properties and, you know, schools and all that stuff. And so we moved up there and we were really indoctrinated at that point. And everything was life or death. Everything was scary, you know. And it was there that I experienced sexual abuse, which was so bizarre in that world of, you know, I didn't even understand like the innuendos at times that were coming from the pulpit, and even the directness of, like, he was known to be quite crass. And so having this happen to me in an environment that was, which I now understand is hyper sexualized, because they're always focusing on that. And so I do believe now at this point in my life that it kind of breeds that activity, right? Because you're always being steered toward those ideas, except you're, like, you know, combating the flesh. And so it's just like this horrible tug of war thing going on. And, you know, it was a while before I realized what had happened. And I just felt like such a dirty piece of trash, because by the time I understood what had happened to me, I had heard enough messaging to make me understand how tainted I was. I think for me, the act was, it was by babysitter. It was not, you know, a lot of times I didn't come to my parents and tell them, well, I didn't really come to my parents and tell them, but I'll go there in a second. But I didn't come to terms with it until I was about 13. And it happened when I was very young, between the ages of 4 and 5. And this we know because that's when we, like, kind of did the math and figured out. And likewise, you know, we were only around them a handful of times. So it wasn't something that was completely ongoing. But the way that I was treated once I went to ask for help because of, you know, the things I was coming to terms with was just, I mean, unspeakable, you know, awful. So I was at church camp I was 13 years old. And again, the IFB is really known for its bluntness. And in the pulpit, they scream, like literally scream into microphones and just use words like Jezebel and whore and harlot and seductress. It was sitting in a pew at church camp. And I'm like, oh, I'm putting two and two together now. Like, I have already hit puberty. I'm a human, so I also have sexual desires. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that's what happened to me.
So I went to
a leader afterwards and I told her, like, hey, this, you know, I haven't told anybody this before, but this happened to me when I was a kid. I didn't know when. I couldn't, like, put all the pieces together. The memories were blurry. And she then automatically, because that's the protocol of the IFB, is like, you have to take it to the man of God. So we went straight to the pastor. I broke down and she just kind of filled in the blanks of, you know, what I had told her. And then by the time we took the long bus ride home, because we drove from Missouri to Tennessee, I wasn't allowed to sit by the girls on the bus after that without a chaperone because they were afraid I was going to talk about something that was, you know, unapproved.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. So you're abused by a babysitter between the ages of 4 and 5. It isn't until you're sitting in church camp and they're just going off on harlots and seductresses and the tantalizing sins of the flesh and how horrific it is that you even go, wait a second. And when you finally realize what it is and get the strength to mention it, it now becomes an issue of the church and you are now no longer safe to sit next to because you know too much and you might accidentally tell the innocents things they shouldn't hear.
Yes.
That is so fucked up.
Yeah, I know.
Yes. Oh my God, Shelley, I'm so sorry.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. But it's why I think that the trauma that I carry, you know, sure, even today, and still work through, is that of the treatment of the people who I thought were there to not only protect me, because they obviously, like, I'm a parent. I know that I'm not always with my children, right? And I don't have control sometimes over what happens. So, you know, I don't blame my parents. But when I went to them for help, that was devastating, that I felt like I didn't have somebody who had my back. And it just confirmed, like, the thoughts that were going on in my head and the reason that made me go to them and be like, oh my gosh, like, this is me, right? This is me. Is this me? Like, I'm, you know, trying to be like, no, it can't be. I can't be the dirty whore. And it was like a confirmation of like, oh no, yeah, that's you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's just such a disservice. I mean, when you look at the media, and you see the people that are waving the flags and flapping their gums and screaming, save the children. It's maybe the same people that weren't interested in helping you at all when you came to them with an actual, hey, I'm a child that needs to be saved. And instead of being like, oh no, one of our children was harmed, we need to fix this. They're like, oh, she's tainted. Keep her away from the other children.
Yeah.
We're saving the other children because you're, like you said, you're a dirty whore. You're a Jezebel. Like, oh, we can't save you. Oops. But we can save the other ones. You need a chaperone to even sit next.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is so the opposite of saving children. Like, it is so to keep the realities away from the children, keep those children in the dark, not make it a teachable moment in any way, not even making you an example, but mm-hmm. no teachable moment in anything here.
Right. Right.
It is pushed under the rug. You are made to be the villain. It's your fault. Whatever. And you're, oh.
Yeah. I mean, it was very traumatizing. Like I said, it is the trauma that the heaviest that I carry, I feel like, in my life. And to my parents' credit, though, so we did leave camp and, you know, I got home. But again, one thing that was another traumatizing experience was that my parents were both at the church to pick me up. So it was like weird. They were both standing in the parking lot. And the pastor called us into the office before we left and relayed to my parents what had happened at camp. So I didn't even get, for the first time, tell my story to my parents.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so to their credit, they were very supportive. My mom actually asked if I wanted to press charges. You know, the statute of limitations wasn't up at that time, but I was 13, maybe 14. Yeah. So I did not know what any of that meant. And then she did share her own experience of sexual abuse as a young woman as well with me. And like, they were able to support me in a way that I did not get from the church. You know, however, I was always put back into that situation where the counseling or the verbiage that they would use was like, but, you know, God can still use you. It's okay that you're, you know, tainted.
Oh, okay.
You know, you'll still find a man to love you.
Gee, thanks.
Yeah. So, I mean, and like I said, my parents weren't that bad about that type of wording, but they reinforced that belief when the church, you know, was the one giving me that kind of help.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That is just so heartbreaking. It is good to know that your parents were supportive. How long did it take everybody to leave the church after this incident came to light?
So my parents never left the church.
They're still in.
Yeah, my dad is deceased, but my mom is still in. And part of my story, and I won't go too much into it, but my brother is public about this part as well, but it is his to share, obviously. So we were together. My brother and I both were abused.
Do you ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet just for anyone to find? I promise it's more than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members. It's all being compiled by data brokers and openly sold online. This can lead to a lot of problems, including identity theft, phishing attempts, harassment, and unwanted spam calls. But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. Signing up for the service is super easy. Just provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. They send you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I got my report, and I was floored with the results. Of the 105 data brokers they checked, 83 of them had my data. Delete Me then removed 173 listings of my personal data off the internet. And they make sure that it stays off too. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me at a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and use promo code MLM at checkout. The only way to get the 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and enter code MLM at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/MLM, code MLM. Head over to quince.com and grab yourself a little something-something and support the show by supporting our sponsors. The weather's getting warmer, so it's time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and say hello to lightweight fabrics and classic styles. I have been taking advantage of the beautiful weather and getting outside for daily walks, and I cannot say enough good things about the Flow Knit high-rise boyfriend jogger from Quince. Seriously, running errands, doing school pickups, swinging by the farmer's market, or taking Zsa Zsa for a stroll around the lake, these bad boys are versatile. I love the deep pockets, the high waistband, and the internal hidden drawstring. They're quick drying, moisture wicking, antimicrobial, and the four-way stretch makes them so comfortable. They're made with 88% recycled polyester, and the Global Style Standard certified yarn dramatically lowers environmental impact by diverting landfill and ocean-bound plastic. Not to mention using recycled claim standard-approved dyeing, washing, and manufacturing processes with low water and eco-friendly dyes. They have become an absolute favorite, and you can save up to 59% off the high-end counterpart by shopping with Quince. Throw on a Cotton Modal scoop neck tee and some sneakers, and you've got a perfect, effortless outfit. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/MLM for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/MLM to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/MLM.
At that time, I don't know if it was something that like he could see what was happening. And it's like, please don't tell my story. And I did not share it with my parents. He didn't actually know that I didn't. and kind of like was mad at me for a while. So that caused some, you know, rift between the two of us for a little while. Like I said, my parents never left the church, but it really shifted everything for my brother. He ended up running away. That changed my relationship with my parents. Before, I was kind of outspoken and I was a little bit rebellious, which, Roberta, let me tell you what rebellious means. In the IFB, rebellious means I snuck out and I wore pants a couple of times. I listened to rock music like Belinda Carlisle.
Oh, no.
Was my favorite. I know, right? I went to a movie a couple of times. I snuck out, and I think probably three times in high school, I went to the movies. So that was my rebellion. And once my brother John ran away, it did kind of change our dynamic in the house. My parents were, gosh, I don't even know if it was because they had lost, because John was always questioning and always combative, and I was the one like sneaking. Like, you know, we've had discussions about like how everybody thought I was like the perfect little model IFB girl, when actually I was just really good at not being caught.
Right.
And so, but John was like, this is ridiculous. I'm out, you know, like to their faces. I'm just like, bro, you suck at this game. But, you know, once that happened, once he decided to leave, he was still in high school. He finished his senior year living in a friend's basement. I basically turned inward and was like, I have to keep the peace. I'm going to be treated like he's being treated. And it was, I don't know what they did to him actually, because there was, he had a firm boundary. There was no communication. Like when he left his note, it said, if you try to contact me, I will call the police. Because in the state of Missouri, when you're 17, you are legally allowed to leave.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know how, like I said, if any communication happened between him and somebody from the church or other family members, but at home and at church, it was like, ooh, you know, John was lost forever. They would pray prayers like that God would do, you know, something to shock him, like meaning they would list things that could happen, like, you know, get him in a car accident and wake him up and, you know, just strange prayers and things. Yeah, that would.
Wow. So much emotional manipulation in just the thoughts of the prayers. Like if we pray and we could emotionally manipulate him to come back and show him, if he got in a car accident, then he'll know what's really right and true in his life and what he should be focused on.
Right.
So at 17, John leaves, and we can have John on and he can talk about his story even more. But
sure.
At 17, John leaves. Is that where your relationship, you said it was kind of rocky at that point. Is that where it ended for the time? Or did you have communication while he was gone?
So we were very close. I am only a year and a few months younger than him. And we were like kind of cohorts, right? We would argue, you know, different things together with my parents. And my dad was, unlike in many families in the IFB, my dad was traditionally educated before he went to seminary there. And so he was a proponent of reading and encouraged us to debate and that kind of thing. And so we would together. And when he left, I did a, you know, 180. And I was like, oh, I'm like, I'm all in. I'm the good girl. I'm not doing that. And so that did put a rift in our relationship for a while. And he was smart not to tell me, because he knew that they'd break me, that I would tell where he went or what he was doing. It was not my parents, I should say too, that were praying those types of prayers. Ironically, it was the leaders and, you know, like some of the biggest names in the IFB would, like, they would come through and they would have revival services and, like, you know, we would tell them our prayer request and they would say those types of things about, you know, God will do what it takes to get him back.
Wow. At what age did you and John reconnect?
I think it was a few years later. He, you know, ended up going to college. I went to college and he then began again speaking to my parents, trying to repair some of that relationship. He would come home for holidays and then we would see each other. And so we stayed connected, but our relationship did not go deeper for a very long time, actually. I ended up going to Hiles Anderson, to the cult college, and he just believed that I was lost to them, you know, to that mentality. We didn't, like I said, talk about the deep things for many years. I would say from the time I was 16 when he left to probably the time I was 36. Yeah, because that's when our dad passed away.
20 years of just having a superficial relationship with the person you used to be the closest with.
Absolutely. Yeah, sadly. I left to go to Hiles Anderson. So one of the requirements is every weekend you have to go and proselytize out in the neighborhoods and things. I don't know if they still do this, but then at least they did. You would knock on doors and you would invite people to church. You would invite them to, you know Jesus. And then we had Bible clubs was what I was involved in. And I ended up in the same neighborhood that I lived in at the time of my abuse. And I began to just have real reactions and physical ailments associated. So I started to have all kinds of tests like MRIs, tons of blood work. I had partial paralysis.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So they just like did not know what was going on. And I did not know actually until just a few years ago that that is not a completely uncommon. I mean, it's not super common, but it is a known reaction to women. And that might apply to men too. But, you know, in the circles I've been involved in, yeah, paralysis is not completely uncommon as a reaction to physical abuse, sexual abuse. All that was going on. And I, of course, didn't realize it. I thought I was sick. I got treatment, different treatments, you know, lots of prayers over me. And I ended up meeting my husband there. So he did not grow up in the IFB. He actually is Romanian. So he grew up overseas. He grew up under the communist dictator Ceausescu, actually.
Yeah.
Now, of course, looking back, it's interesting how our lives connected and how many similarities that we could understand each other. Because within a few weeks of him being there, he called it a cult. And he actually labeled it as Christian communism.
Wow. He could see it.
Yeah. And so he ended up leaving and I, you know, begged him to come back. Because I was too scared to leave. My parents ended up calling the son-in-law, who became the leader after Jack Hiles died. And my mom called him and said, I'm afraid Shelly's going to run away with George. So you got to stop it. You have to save them. So he made me promise that I would not break his heart and leave with George. I did not. And I, you know, I went, I'm a singer. So I tried out. I made it for the groups that went all across the nation singing and trying to get kids to come to our college. And yeah, so I was like all in. I could see how from the time I just really bought all in that my position was elevated. And so it started to work for me, right?
Right.
George finally came back and we ended up getting married and I finished schooling. They gave him a 1-year degree so they could like claim him, I feel like. It's so weird.
That's so strange.
I know, right? And then, because George had told me from the get-go, like, I'm not staying here. I'm, you know, going back home. And so we moved. We moved to Romania for 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, that's a clean break.
Right.
Obviously, we had an ocean between us. And though I have learned that there are IFB churches there started by American missionaries, but there's a very, very small presence of the IFB in Romania. And so I just lived a very different life and was able to learn that, you know, faith does not look like that. And when my dad passed away suddenly, like I said, I was 36 years old. John actually was the one who said, you know, we need to like call the church and see what kind of widow's aid we can get mom.
Right.
And I was like, we do not want to be beholden to any cult. Like, no. And he was like, what'd you just say? I was like, that place is a cult. And he's like, I knew that was a cult. I didn't know you knew that was a cult. Yeah. And so thus began, you know, the close relationship that we now have again today. Yeah, I kind of feel like I regained my best friend. So,
well, still, yeah. How respectful of John to not push his idea of it being a cult on you and letting you figure it out and realize that and come to him and really say that. And him being like, wait a second, welcome to this side. You know, you can scream at people right in the face, right from the pulpit, right with a microphone. You can scream in their faces. And they're still not going to hear you if they're not ready to hear you. And at no point when you were still connected to the IFB, were you willing to let it go? It wasn't until George took you to another country where there was not that constant presence.
Yeah.
For you to actually get the chance to breathe and think on your own and come to all of these conclusions by just unpacking things and going, well, that's weird. Why is that weird? Let me look into that. Oh, that's a panic attack. That's why I felt like that. And really start unpacking everything so that you could come to the conclusion of it's a cult and have this full circle moment where your brother's like, oh my God, I just got you back. I think it's so cool how John just sort of accepted you as who you were in that moment.
Yes, yes. And it was so nice because my parents were, like I said, still in. And my dad actually ended up becoming a pastor at one of the churches. And so John would go wherever they were when I would come home to visit my parents. And he would just come see us and be part of, you know, our lives still. And like you said, just the generosity. And he's such a good human. So yeah. I'm really thankful to have him as my brother.
I have a question about you being at the college. One of the things you have to do as a member of the college is to proselytize door to door once a week.
Yes.
You just pick a day?
No, it's on Saturdays, at least for the girls. I think you can do it any day of the week, but girls were not allowed to leave campus anytime.
Oh,
we.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You could get a special pass with approval and, you know, you have to have an approved girl with you. Yeah, it's a whole system.
What about the boys? Could they leave freely?
Yes, you know, because they're guys.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Wild. And so... on Saturdays, they would have these big green buses and they would bus us to downtown Chicago, which, hello. Anyway, just drop a bunch of girls off in skirts in the freezing Chicago weather. That was the other thing. It's like, oh my God, we were not protected.
In just random neighborhoods.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they chose them, but they were totally random to us. But yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And how successful were those Saturdays for the church?
I mean, like I said, they boast to have 1,000 and like the auditorium seats 5,000 or so. The newer one, because they have a new one since I was there and it's bigger. But I know the old one that we were in sat 5,000 or like right around that. And it was packed every Sunday.
Wow.
So, you know, in multiple buildings, they had a Spanish church. So they have a whole like thousands of people with the Spanish message and stuff. So, I mean, it's a lot.
Wow.
And they are the ones known for, like, we called it the bus program. So like a spring program and a fall program. And you would like have this guy who's like going to eat a goldfish if you get this many visitors, or, you know, you would give them candies and it, yeah, just weird, weird stuff.
Like a circus. Like,
yes, definitely.
Come get some popcorn definitely. And peanuts if you come to our church service.
Oh, literally, we had a dunk tank because we were I'm not kidding. We were having this promotion to where we would be able to dunk our leader if we reached a certain amount of people. So yeah, wow. It was a requirement. And on Monday you had to fill out an activity report that, you know, said, you know, how many people you spoke to, where you were, how many hours. Cause I think the requirement was at least 1 hour, but let's be honest, for us girls, they left us out on the streets for 8 hours.
Wow.
And then they came back and picked us up.
What were some of the strangest encounters you got on the other side of that door when you would knock?
Confession. I mean, are they going to revoke my diploma? Who knows? But it's not like it's worth anything. But I was really bad at it. We would talk to like kids on the street, but when I was in the neighborhood where I grew up, and then I ended up not going there for a while, but when I was there, there was this old elderly lady that we would help her do her shopping on the weekends. And we ended up spending most of our time there until Bible clubs. And then if we saw like kids at the park or something, we just like go grab a few kids and tell them to come with us and have some fun and count that as our person about talking, you know, talking to about Jesus. And then when I was in Chicago, we met like fascinating guy. I actually did a whole series, like a fictional story series about this guy that we met. He was in his 90s. We were actually invited to his 100th birthday party by his family because they loved us. He used to be the chef at the Drake Hotel in downtown Chicago.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Right. And I mean, like, this was in 1994. He was born in 1894-5. Maybe he turned 195, I think. Yeah. He had the best stories about the 20s. people coming into the Drake Hotel. And we would just sit there and listen to his stories and clean his house, do his laundry and that kind of thing. And again, like we would talk to, there was a Chinese shop that we really loved and we would go and we would sit and have Chinese soup and they'd give us free cookies.
Wow.
So yeah, we would hide out a little bit. I was not the best at that. Yeah. So.
I mean, it's kind of a hard job.
It is. So I was a big fat liar every single week. I would just fill out that report and be like, yeah, I saw somebody on the street and said hello. Totally. I have Jesus in my eyes, obviously.
The only person who wouldn't know would be Jesus himself. He'd be like, you didn't do that. You weren't at that guy's house hearing about the Drake Hotel. You weren't proselytizing to the children.
We were totally not. So for my part, for me and like my roommate and another friend, yeah, they got nothing from us. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how old were you when everything is said and done and you're like, this is done forever. I'm done. What was that age?
Oh gosh, Roberta, that's a hard question because I feel like it was a real unraveling. So you're like, you know, you start to pull on that thread. And when I left the country, I was 23. It was probably right away because the life was so different there. And my husband had changed my mind about a lot of things. You know, it was, like I said, a slow unraveling. I would just be like, that doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem right. And then I would have experiences to lay on top of them. And I have to say, too, though, after about 4 or 5 years overseas and having such vastly different experiences and still not like feeling the wrath of God on me, I got scared. I thought that like, oh, but it's probably coming.
Oh.
So I need to kind of like go and dive back in for a little bit. And I did that. I tried to make it make sense. And so I went back for, they called it the Christian Womanhood Conference. And I, again, I still lived overseas, but I made a special trip. My daughter and I, you know, met my mom and my best friend and my sister and her sister all up there at that conference. And I mean, I was probably, I don't know, probably 30, maybe a little younger. I was sitting there and listening to the leader's wife speak and be really formulaic, which I get because that's how it was. Like, you're supposed to do this. And then, of course, this will happen. And then all of these things will follow through. And I'm just like, but that's bullshit. You know, I'm sitting there like just listening, thinking that's not true. I think it was then that I was like, I don't know if any of this is true. So then I went home and went back one more time. And I told George, my husband, when we were there, we were literally walking out of the church because it was like when we were home visiting. And I was like, don't ever bring me back here. I can never come back. And so I think my son, Bobby, was what, probably 6 years old. So I must have been 31. I would have been 31 because I was 26 when I had him. Yep. And I was like, that's it. Never again. And shortly thereafter, I started calling it a cult. I mean, just between my husband and me and trying to unpack everything. And he was even reticent to use the word because he was like, oh, wow, that's pretty dramatic, you know. And it wasn't until we were watching the series, The Aftermath, like before Netflix, like we watched it when it first came out.
Yeah.
We were watching that and he turned to me during one episode and he was like, it was a cult.
You know, I always say this anytime Aftermath and Leah like come up on the show, I'm always like, I wonder if she knows that yet another person was like, oh shit, this is a cult just from watching her show.
Like, but nobody else was talking about it or doing that kind of thing, you know, and no. She, like, how much did she risk to do that? Like, Scientology is just vicious and litigious and she's so brave. And thank God, thank God. Cause like When I looked at my husband, I was like, if we're watching something about Scientology and we can equate IFB to that, then that's like everything to me. It was so validating. Like, then it's legit a cult.
You know? Yeah. Scientology is one of my favorite cults to like compare things to because I feel like everyone, aside from Scientologists, know that Scientology is a cult. People are like, yeah, that's a cult. Yeah. Like, there's no question. There's no like, oh, well, they do some good stuff. Or, oh, but my mom was, you know, it's not like that the way that it is with Christianity or the way that it is with like MLMs or anything like that. And so I love to use Scientology as the, look at this horrific thing they're doing. And then being like, oh, but look, the exact same thing is happening in this other less, quote, culty thing that people are like, it's not a cult. And I'm like, they're doing the exact same thing as Scientology.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's that comparison to that known cult, like that control source, right? Like they're like, that's the control. Scientology is the control. So if other things are acting like that, yes, like, wow, there is a connection there. And again, like I said, it surprises me, but at the same time, it doesn't surprise me anytime the words aftermath come out in a sentence when I'm asking people, like, when did you realize they're like the aftermath show? I'm like, okay.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
It's amazing.
And today I've got my Scientology sweatshirt that says, not today, Thetan.
Oh my God. I did not even see that until you. Oh my goodness. I love that. I need to get that. Oh my God.
It's a good one.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. It's such a perfect comparison to be like, oh, you think that's culty? Let me tell you that I experienced the exact same thing, but let me give you the examples so that you can see it as what it is. And yeah, once you see control, you see control. Like your husband coming from communist Romania.
Right.
And yeah, being in this college and being like, this is like Romania again. Like this is a cult.
Yes.
This is communism. They're controlling you.
Yes.
And like him seeing that. And then you both seeing it with Scientology and being like, yeah, it's really interesting because it's systemic and it is a pattern. It is formulaic. It follows a specific way. It has to go this certain way or it doesn't work. It's a slow burn in and then it's a nasty burn on the way out. And it's just how it's done.
Yeah.
And anybody that's listening who constantly, I see comments all the time. I don't think anybody that listens, who's like a fan and a listener, thinks this, but anybody who might be randomly listening, they always think I'm too smart to fall for a cult.
Yeah.
I'm too educated. I make too much money, or I have too good of friends, or there's nothing that I'm lacking in my life that I would be so vulnerable as to fall for something like this. And I'm like, I just don't think you've met the right group yet.
Yeah.
I just think it's still coming if you haven't done it.
Yeah.
Because anybody can be susceptible to anything like this.
Yeah. And I don't think any of us want to live with the idea that we can't believe somebody at face value. And so if you're going to encounter a narcissist, you know, a manipulative person, you're going to at first give them the benefit of the doubt. And if you're not well-versed in those red flags, you can have a long road before you even see any of it. And here's the thing, Roberta, we can have all the education. We can be in this space. We can, you know, think that, yeah, I've like, you know, I'm educating people. I'm learning. And at the end of the day, somebody's going to take advantage of us, literally. Like, and it's the same, like you said, it's kind of the same formula, right? It might not always go to the thousands of followers, you know, cult leader level, but it's the same tactic. So I can't ever like think that I'm above it even now.
No, yeah, same. Even if you feel like I'm never going to join another church, I'm never going to join another MLM, I'm never going to buy a weird product and like get really into like the community and I'm good on that. Like you might have a best friend who's super manipulative and controlling, or you might start dating somebody who is a narcissist and you don't realize that you're now in a cult of one because you're not looking at that cult of one. You're only looking for the big things that you're avoiding.
Right.
And so it's just, there's so many instances where these things can happen, whether you're born into it like you were, or you choose it like other people do, or you don't choose it. You think you're joining something and it's something completely different like mine.
Yeah.
anybody, and I really hope that people listening are like nodding their heads like, yes, anybody. There is no like, oh, well, I'm cured, or, oh, I'm immune. It doesn't happen like that.
Right.
To just hear all of these different stories and all of the connections that you had to all these other cults and realizing it is you're unpacking things, and George as well. It's just, once you see it, you are better at seeing it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll see it every single time, but you are a little better at seeing it once you've been through it, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And hopefully it'll prevent you from going to the lengths or the depths that you have previously been in, right? You do see it sooner. You don't second guess yourself as much. That's really, for me, a big turning point was the fact that I realized I could trust myself, that it had an, you know, an opposite effect probably of what I would assume that it would, because at first I was devastated. I thought I would die, because all along I could trust myself felt like the most massive betrayal on the planet. Like, oh, I have lost so many years and I could have trusted myself. But thankfully, through therapy,
yes,
I was able to work through that and really lean into the, it's okay to trust yourself. And there are moments I don't, but I get to that space faster now than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. I even think back sometimes in interactions with people, not that just an interaction is cult, but it can be very manipulative and controlling in certain instances. Somebody convincing you to do something you don't want to do, whether it's like trying to cancel something on the phone or anything. Like, I find myself in those instances where I'm like, I have to trust myself. I have to know that this is what I want and this is what I want to do. And then I also think back to like relationships that didn't work out, when you break up and think like, oh man, like, all the stuff I said no to because that partner like didn't want to, or you thought that they would have like an adverse reaction to the things you want to do. It's that same feeling, whether you're like, you know, like, I should have done it. My ex didn't want me to, and I should have done it. That same feeling that you're feeling, in that the whole time I could have trusted myself, the whole time I could have zigged when everyone else was like, you should zag. I could have zigged, and I always zagged because it was just easier to go with the flow or whatever. It's that same feeling. I don't know if I'm like expressing myself the right way, because I feel like I'm kind of getting this language right now, but that feeling, I don't know. Like, I think, bring it back to a Taylor Swift lyric, and it's like the rubies that I gave up in choosing one over the other. The rubies that I gave up. Like, I think of that. Like, I could have trusted myself the whole time. I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to go that place or whatever. Like, trusting your gut and knowing you're in a bad situation and believing that you in that moment know what's best for you in that moment, and getting that back must just feel so freeing and wonderful.
It does now. You know, like I said, it didn't at the beginning. It just felt like so overwhelming and scary. And, you know, the instinct was to convince myself that wasn't true, because that's the way I was taught all along, right? You're not supposed to trust anything. And so if you are doing anything that is against these rules, then it's on you. So you have to like retrain yourself to, you know, go the right direction, right? So my instinct was to be like, no, 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 this can't be true. This can't be true. This can't be true. Like, if it's true, then nothing matters in life. I was very nihilistic at that point, you know.
We believe in nothing, Lebowski.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then, you know, yeah, now it's just like, oh, I take a breath, take a beat. I can trust myself here. And it can be as simple as like, I love that you brought up like, you know, a subscription or whatever. It's like, I would say yes to every freaking thing because I was like embarrassed or like, sorry, didn't want to, you know, like waste somebody's time or I have no problem now, which is like, no thanks. I'm good.
Like, I'm really getting good at saying no to people.
That's awesome. I love it. Yes.
Yeah. It's something that I think those of us who have been victims of high demand control, because you know the alternative of speaking out to something is that you're going to be made an example of. So you just sort of don't say anything or just go with the flow, and then breaking out of that and unpacking that and like just realizing that like no is a complete sentence, and like it doesn't mean not right now. It can just be like no. And people are like, oh, okay, that's fine. And I'm like, oh my God, they're not mad at me. Like, I said no, maybe next time. And they're like, okay, cool. Maybe I'll see you next time. Yeah. It's just, it's been a big realization.
I know, same, same. Yes. And you spoke of examples too, like growing up, there would be like people called out from the pulpit right there, you know, and like names and, you know, like I said, just screaming and kicking microphones was a big deal. He was known for like kicking down microphones and like the stage, you can imagine like with that many people, the platform had to be pretty tall. So there was like this flowing staircase and they would just tumble down the staircase. And it was like a big, yeah, theatrical display of anger. So yeah, like you would never want to be that person, you know, no, to set off that anger. And though it was, you know, much lower risk in other situations, that was the environment I was raised in. And so it was like, sure, of course I was a people pleaser.
Right.
It was not safe to not be.
Right. You know?
Yeah.
It's just the more that I talk to my friend, like this is just, this conversation has just been really great because I've only ever known you as a collaborator and like, it's just somebody that I met in this space, like, oh my gosh, me too kind of person. And to get here and to sit and to actually have a conversation and ask you questions and relate in different ways to your story and just get to know you deeper. It has been such a pleasure for me this afternoon to do that with you, Shelley.
Oh, thank you, Robert. I feel the same way. Thanks.
Yeah. It's just, you have such an incredible story. I would love to talk to John. I mean, I've talked to John before, but I would love to have John come on the show. You guys are going to love John. Like, I know Shelley says he's great, but like, I can corroborate that he's great.
Yeah, he's so great.
To come and add the second half of the puzzle piece to that story, that early adopter of leaving your family behind and having to live with that and then having to be quiet and letting them come to their own. Like, I can't wait. I'm going to, yeah, we're going to talk to John. We're going to have him come on the show.
You should.
Before we get to my rapid fire questions, where can everybody find you?
Yeah, so you can find me on social media at Shelley Snowportia. You can find me on my website, shelleysnowportia.com. So it's just my name anywhere. Put it in Google. I'm the only one that exists. So you'll find my books and all the stuff I do. So yeah, and I have a new novel coming out. Check that out. It's called The Cheating Wife. And it's a story about a woman who has been steeped in a relationship with a man who is really well known both in his community and in religious circles. And so just dealing with the aftermath of the abuse that she endures and the courage that she has to walk away. Yeah, I've just used a lot of my own experiences to kind of formulate this story that is a lot about patriarchy. And I always find escape in fiction to explore the deepest truths in my own life.
Awesome. Oh, wow. Cool. I'm really excited. I will throw the links to everything in the show notes so people can find you and they can grab a copy of your book as well.
Awesome.
Okay. Are you ready?
I am.
I got some questions.
Yes.
All right. Shelley, give me one word that encompasses how you feel about your upbringing in the IFB.
Disgusted.
Give me a piece of advice to somebody who's maybe in this denomination or is looking to get out. What's something that you would tell somebody who's looking to break free from high demand control?
Ask questions and be willing to arrive at a different answer than the one that's given to you, because there are people on the other side that are safe.
I love that. Okay. An MLM question, all right?
Okay.
I need to know.
Yeah.
It's burning. It's burning in my soul. What is the worst MLM in your opinion?
Oh my gosh. So we did not even talk about MLM stuff, Roberta. I would have to say Amway because, of course, my parents were in Amway, you know, in the 80s. And so—
Of course they were.
Of course. So like, you know, the grandfather of us all, I'm going to go with Amway. So— Yeah.
It's a just answer for sure. Give me the hardest lesson you learned in the IFB.
Wow. The hardest lesson I learned in the IFB, that I am worthy of standing up for myself. Yeah. That came with a lot of punishments, but I think that when it did happen, I was able to look back when I ended up walking away, that I did have the strength because of some of the circumstances that, you know, I experienced in the IFB. So being able to just feel worthy of being here.
Yeah. And then finally, give me the positive takeaway from your time in the IFB.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I think that the positive thing is that I was too scared to get into like a lot of trouble. So I've never like, you know, I don't have a CD pass. I don't like, I've never experienced drugs or, you know, had addictions or things like that, that I know that that was the intention that my parents had, that, you know, that worked. I was kept away from that stuff. So I'm going to say that's a positive thing.
Yeah.
Right.
You stayed out of trouble. I mean, you got into different trouble, but you stayed out of conventional trouble.
Conventional trouble, you know. So I did go to movies and that, so it's all relative.
Wow. Yeah, you're such a rebel, like going to the movies. How dare you?
It's bad. It's really, and I don't even have remorse, Roberta. Like,
I wouldn't
it's
either.
That kind of level.
I would not have any remorse for the all of your rebellious. I mean, the fact that your rebellious time was like, I went to the movies. And it's wild to me because the people I talk to, they're wonderful people that all turned out really great. And right. Like the worst things that they did in life were like totally normal things that aren't bad at all outside of the realm of this like strange culty control.
I know, right? Like sneaking pants underneath my big flowing jean skirt to go to the baseball game was like, I was so scared I was going to get in trouble and someone would see me and catch me and all that. Yeah. So it's so crazy. And like looking back, just thinking the fact that my parents had like so much invested in this and, you know, it was like evil and we felt so bad about ourselves. And I was like, we could have like not felt so bad about ourselves.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the other hard realization. You're like the whole time, like we could have figured this, that it was a cult and we could have been watching movies the whole time.
Right?
We could have been wearing pants the whole time.
Whole time.
Like all of this was for nothing.
Yeah.
It's just, you're not a rebel. You are a wonderful, and you know what? Even if you are, I kind of like it. You're a wonderful, incredible woman. I am so proud to call you my friend. I'm so proud that we have been able to do work together in this space. And I want to say thank you again for coming on the show and sharing your story and being so vulnerable. Mm. I'm really proud of you.
Thank you so much, Roberta. This has been a pleasure. And you know, every time I tell this, and I don't think I've ever actually gone into the story as deeply as I have here, but each time it brings just a little bit more healing into my life. So thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing.
Of course. Yeah. I think it's important. You get to heal. I get to heal. The listeners get to heal. We all take something from it that's a little different and apply it to our lives or come up with a new realization of like, oh my gosh, I never put that two and two together. Wow. Like, that's what I love about this show. That's what I love about these conversations. And I'm just so happy that you're a part of it now. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast or visit our website at lifeaftermlmpod.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon for exclusive content and join the community on Discord. You can find all of the links to follow in our show notes. Life After MLM is produced by Roberta Blevins. Audio editing is done by the lovely Kayla Craven. Video editing by the indescribable RK Gold. And Michelle Carpenter is our triple emerald princess of robots. If you have a story about a cult, fraud, scam, or MLM and want to be on the show, please hit us up. We would love to help you tell your story and start your healing journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Huns.